You're listening to the One Eyed Man podcast. I am Mike Stopforth, your host, and today I am talking to Neo Moleko and Brad Simons from Monaka Coffee. If you haven't heard of Monaka Coffee, you've been living under a rock. This is the second episode in our Original by Tradition entrepreneurship series, brought to you, of course, by the Glenlivet. Now, what would make a couple of old school friends start a new coffee brand when the likes of Seattle, Vida, and even international brands like Starbucks exist as competition already? Well, these two guys will tell you that it's a firm belief that African innovation and originality can bring something really unique, something fresh to even the most crowded industries or sectors. The Monaka story really is one of hope. And that's my wish for you today as you listen to this show. We could all use a ray of optimism, a sense of possibility, if you like. And so without any further ado, the Monaka team. Yeah, so Neo, maybe we could start with you. For people who are not familiar with the Monaka brand, and I'm actually sitting here with a cup of Fats and Bones blend out of my machine at home as we speak. So I'm clearly a fan. But for people who aren't familiar with the brand and the brand journey, can you tell us a little bit about how it came about and what, I guess, inspired you to start a coffee brand?
It was very, very simple. Myself and Brad have been friends now since 98. You know, we met back at school, in high school. We went to the same school, King Edward in Houghton. Raised by my
condolences.
Yeah, and our friendship has always been around. When Brad went over to South Korea, he kept in touch with myself. At the time, I was involved in another business of my own, which is in the personnel space, right? So personnel development, recruitment, placements, the traditional recruitment and placements with a touch of consulting. And in 2015, I think it was late on in the year of 2015, Brad had a very great experience with coffee, having traveled around the world as he was, you know, in South Korea. And he shared this experience with me and, you know, just telling me, listen, dude, I've tasted this wonderful coffee. And, you know, I really think, you know, there's a market in South Africa. And just, you know, just really bouncing off his thoughts, you know, what do you think? You know, I'm thinking of starting this coffee business. And I was at the time, I was like, listen, dude, you know, go for it, right? Whatever exposure that you've had, go for it. See how it works. And if it doesn't fly, it's a great lesson. You know what I'm saying? I mean, because that's what business is full of. And early in 2016, Brad embarked on starting a business called Fats and Bones. Fats being the nickname that I gave him in Standard 6. You know, Standard 6, we all come in with baby fat from Standard 5.
Yeah.
And
And
at the time, another, you know, friend of ours was involved in the inception of a business, and so the business was then called Fats and Bones at the beginning. I think my months may not be accurate, but maybe about 3 to 6 months later. At the time, I had requested that Brad actually roast me some beans. Now, coming back from, you know, growing up in Soweto and having kind of sold a few items now and then. And actually whiskey being one of them, you know, I said to myself, listen, dude, roast me some beans. I want to actually go and look at the emerging market. So this really being townships, you know, black market essentially. And I want to just basically see how this works. And I also thought, you know, with my exposure to some of the corporates, my clients in the recruitment space, you know, maybe there could be a discussion had there. Anyway, that ran for about 3 months. And in that 3 months, I mean, a lot of strategic discussions were had between myself, Brad, and then our former partner. And a quick decision was made that, listen, it actually doesn't make sense for us to be running parallel with the same product in a country that we, you know, that we're in. Why don't we use, you know, advantages and some of our disadvantages, you know, to kind of like strengthen the business. And that's where, you know, we came with the decision of, you know, rebranding and starting the business called Monaka, right? And Monaka is basically a Sotho word just describing horns. It could be horns of various animals. But in this case, what was developed and designed was, you know, horns of a bull. So my interest getting into the business and starting it off with Monaka was really purely from exposing people that I know that I had access to what we kind of did not understand and the levels of coffee. So I grew up, I'm a traditional red coffee and, you know, your chicory labels. And I felt, you know what, here's another angle where I can expose people that either following me or my friends or family, and there's a business opportunity. And that's how I got into the business. That's how I got exposed to coffee. So at this level of beans, espressos, cappuccinos, flat whites, and all the fancy stuff around coffee, this for me has been a five-year journey. And there's a whole lot of learning to do. And there's still a whole lot of learning for, you know, our customers. And that's what really pulled me in. And, you know, there's money to be made. But I think also just exposing people to what's out there was part of the, you know, the journey. With the background of personnel and consulting and somewhat training, which is really a core of teaching, you know, that to me kind of like, it was really like, look, now there's a product, there's a space, there's an opportunity here for people to learn.
Yes.
And overlaid with the fact that you can actually create opportunities for employment, right?
Yes.
The country that we live in, a business like ours, you know, relies a lot on personnel, on staff.
So that insight, I think, is a critical insight that I really want to dig into, because I think that's going to be a key part of a lot of our discussion. But Brad, I mean, the first time we met, I was buying a coffee machine for my previous business, Cerebra. And today, if I want to go visit Monaco, there's this beautiful flagship store literally within walking distance of my house at Polo Fields, which could easily hold its own against like the premium coffee houses around the world. Yeah. But, you know, people often forget that they experienced the brand like that, but it didn't start that way. So talk me through kind of the various stages and evolutions of the business, because the version we see now, I guess, is we sometimes don't appreciate the hard yards that went into making that a possibility.
Yeah, it's so accurate what you just said there. But I think the key word there is, you said around the world. Okay, so it's a big part of our inspiration, right? So I land up going overseas. I was in the design and marketing space, studied at Vega, etc. You know, I worked through the industry for a while. Not excelling, you know, to the maximum, but I knew what I was doing. But I just got tired of it. Yeah. Decided to go travel, and I landed up. Long story short, I landed up living in South Korea. Now, I live across the road, and I literally mean no more than 10 meters away from a coffee roastery. I kind of had it in my mind that I was going to go out there and find a product that I could come back with, because I didn't make a very good employee. I'm not – like I had a seven-month itch.
I hear you.
Yeah. not a great employee. I like to move around. I went back and forth to jobs before, and I just couldn't really settle. So now I was looking for something. I knew I wanted to start my own business. No clue on what, you know, what that actually means. But the thing that I noticed when I came back to South Africa after experiencing, like, I had a cup of coffee in Korea. I remember the cup, and it's Ethiopian Sidamu 2. That was the bean. And I drank it, and I was like, what is this? I literally said to the guy, what is this? Okay. And he spoke me through it and started teaching me a little bit about specialty coffee and then the roasting. And I was there for the best part of 4 years. That's where I learned to do that. I went then and I did a barista's course. I really got into coffee, and I was like, man, this is cool. But I still wasn't 100% sure on, you know, is that the thing I'm taking back? But it was in the back of my mind. And it was pretty much like the morning after, or the one or two mornings since I got back to Joburg, and I woke up and I couldn't find the coffee I was looking for. You know, I was used to this certain level of coffee. And couldn't really find it. I had to literally travel 20 kilometers to go and find a place that was, you know, doing something in that sort of space. And I mean, there was a 20 kilometer gap in the market, you know, that I could see.
Sure.
I mean, it's in your mind. I mean, starting a business is very sort of romanticized, you know. Yeah, I'm going to start this business, and you're going to be your own boss, and you're going to do your own things. And it's, I mean, as you know, and a lot of people that have ever tried know that it's everything but romantic, you know. So I started a friend of mine at the time. I told him this is what I wanted to do, and he said, "Okay, cool, let's do it together." He was running a successful business at the time, and he was going to give me the ins and outs of how to do it. We started the Fats and Bones, and I believe Fats and Bones was the brand that actually went into Base 2. when they
okay.
So that was the connection to Wunderman, which, you know, later on landed up me selling a coffee machine.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there was a fallout with the partner. But before that, we, you know, as Nao had mentioned, you know, we got to a point where it was like, listen, we're running these two parallel brands. We were basically just we'd rebranded the current Fats and Bones offering as it was called Stimela, which Nao was running, and it just made sense, you know, to put everything together. I mean, whether Nao knows it or not, you know, earlier on in those earlier conversations, I'd already pegged him as somebody that, you know, that was most likely going to get involved with the brand. So that was why I let the brands run together, see how that goes, and then, you know, put them together if need be. Another important, you know, factor in that was that Nao had met a guy who's another partner in the business, Pumlani, who's a coffee roaster. Okay, and we, at the time, we started having trouble with our coffee roaster. We couldn't get the consistency in the blend that we created. And we needed somebody that could, you know, could do better. So it all sort of in sequence landed up, Pumlani involved, Nao involved, myself involved. Like I said, the other partner, yeah, unfortunately, we had a fallout. And we decided to, you know, rebrand as Monaca. And from there was the first steps of the brand as you know it today.
Sorry, Brad. I just wanted to ask for some clarification there, because I think there's a really important lesson that I just want to extract out of there quickly. You'd always had the vision of, I guess, this kind of array of beautiful stores that were supplying world-class coffee where you controlled the supply chain. And a lot of people have that kind of vision and a really good idea for a business, regardless of what it is, right? Like in your case, a coffee shop, but it could be anything. But I think what you guys realized early on is that you had to do different things to make that thing a possibility. The ideal version of that wasn't going to be possible immediately, right? So there was an element of wholesale and, you know, there were different things that you were doing to build up, I guess, the momentum to get that first store open. Is that correct in saying?
Absolutely. Sorry, just to go back, like when I started the last conversation, that world, you know, being worldly or being able to
compete world-class.
On a world-class stage, that has always been the goal. Like you said, if you go to that store, we've always had something to compare it to, you know, through the experiences that we've had. Myself, Nao, and Pumlani went to Korea and Japan in 2019. And I mean, a big part of that, there was other reasons for that we went, but a big part of that was so that I could show what's going on in my mind. You know, guys, this is where I'm living, you know,
in terms experience of the vision. Yeah.
Come and experience this so that, I mean, if the three of us are thinking the same thing, it's going to be far more powerful than just me trying to say, no, it's got to be like this, got to be like this, got to be like this.
Sure.
And what, once we opened that shop here, the Waterfall, the Polo Field shop, so often, and it's quite funny how the sort of universe gives back some sort of feedback as to that you're on the right path. It's like people call it world class all the time. They say this, I've traveled the world and this is as good as any cafe I've ever been in. You know, like we hear that stuff a lot. And that's sort of that, you know, okay, we're doing this right sort of moment. Yeah, that reassurance. But it started off, I mean, the big part of our business was corporates. All we had, we didn't have a shop, we didn't have money. I spent 5,000 rand to get the first blend made, that first Fats and Bones blend. The rest of my money was on me living, you know. Didn't take a salary until probably somewhere in the second year. And it was just wholesale. It was us selling to corporates like yourselves and started that supply. And that was a huge core, you know, piece of our business. I'd say it made up probably 65 to 70% of the business until 2019 when COVID came and just wiped us out. There were some strategies that had taken place before that. I mean, because we've only got 40 minutes, I'll speed the process up. But we started with the wholesale. We identified the fact that we're going to need a space for people to experience the brand, to experience the coffee, because we found that when people had tried it, there was always repeat business on our online platform, okay? And it was very difficult to get first-time buyers online. But once they tasted it, a lot, and even still today, a lot of the stuff is you know, the second time somebody's buying beans, for example.
Got you.
We then approached who's now also a partner, Alex from Jameli. And we'd had our a coffee in his restaurant for a couple of months. And I'd gone to him and said, listen, is there perhaps somebody here that you know that could help us with some money? Because we need to build our own roastery and our own space. Yeah. From there, you know, the kind of, there's some more, obviously some more story as to where we are now. But that was the big jump, was getting the investment, you know, and then, you know, making good on it.
So now as a customer and a fan of the brand, my experience of it for a while was, you know, as Brad alluded to, ordering my favorite blend online and trying the Nguni blend and then trying, you know, I'm a fats and bones guy, but I'd branch out every now and again.
Sure.
And imagine my joy then to see the first forecourt store opening again, literally within a walking distance of my door. And then before I knew it, I would bump into Brad on the odd occasion at the Sasol across the road. And he was telling me, watch the space because things are happening. And I was like, yeah, sure, bud. I'm sure. Yeah. You know, because everybody's got a big idea, right? And before I knew it, you guys had stores everywhere. So talk to me about, because kind of there was a sense that it just went, talk to me first of all about opening up that first real, like retail space and what you learned around that. Tell me a little bit about why you picked this part of the world, the sort of Waterfall Midrand area, and maybe fill us in on what's happened since then.
Sure. So look, I think in terms of picking the area, our decisions, our actions, the energy that we put into the business kind of attracted the right energy. And by that I mean, you know, we were actually identified by customers, right? Our first real space that we didn't intend to make a retail front was actually the roastery that we then opened after we agreed with Alex Hojani to, you
know, yes, partner. Yes.
And that wasn't Bryanston. And
yes,
although we didn't have the intention of having, you know, kind of a retail front, the space was there, the possibilities, and we said, look, if it does happen, the customers come through, let at least look, you know, look of the level that we'd like. We had customers that actually popped in, and those customers today, for the last time, you know, became our new set of partners, right? And those set of partners, you know, came with an offering that made strategic sense and was in line with the vision that we originally had.
Yes.
At key times in the journey, even when Alex became partner, you know, the biggest thing was, you know, what do we see for the business? What does the person that wants to be involved, you know, want to do with the business? And ultimately, it was to be the most loved coffee business in the world. Now, when we aligned on vision there, it made pure sense. And when they then expressed the sort of rollout strat in a way that was in line with our vision, it was just an easy decision to make. And that's how we landed up in this space of Waterfall. We didn't really have much choice in terms of the Sasol and the design at the time, but you know, we speak a lot about energy and the universe, but you know, it just so happened that the space that they had already built was really in line with our colors, with our ambience, maybe just one or two or a couple of percentage that was offline, but we just kind of like fitted there as if we were in the original plans. And when we opened it on Waterfall Road, you know, things fell into place. Obviously, we had to execute other elements of the business, which is, you know, look and feel, the staff that we get there, the level of training. So everything came in at the right time with the right energy.
Not exactly at the right time. They gave us 3 weeks to set it up.
Oh, well.
So we just thought, like, listen, we've got this Sasol and we need a coffee outfit for it. We love you guys. Can you go? Yeah. Would you like to come in here? And we're like, absolutely. Okay, cool.
The cat. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, true.
Oh, my word.
True.
So you had to do design, shop fitting, machinery, training, so basically within 3 weeks.
Machinery, training, and design of sort of the elements. Not exactly the actual architecture. Nothing. But in 3 weeks. And we did it.
Trained the guys as well, very short term.
They're still the same baristas today that are working there. I think it's, what, 2.5 years?
Yeah, I recognize the guys. Yeah, I know them well now. Yeah.
And that's really part of it as well. I mean, you talk about the experience that you have when you walk into our stores, and it's very easy for us to have a beautiful brand that's appealing to the eye, you know, to be in a slightly well-deserved position of being able to, you know, have the right architecture and ambience. And, you know, those things cost, right? And if we can't complement it with the skill set, with the staff that stand behind and actually engage you and kind of pick your brain in terms of, you know, having the next coffee. And if we can't match it, then it's not going to be world class. It'll look beautiful, but it just won't be world class. And that's one element that we've taken extremely seriously. And you've heard it with many businesses across the world. You know, your staff are a very key part of the business. And I think we can pat ourselves and, you know, we've done fairly well. There's times where obviously you can never really get 100% with staff. We're human beings, right? You're dealing with a very,
sure,
you know, that goalpost always moves with a human being, but how we adapt to it, I think we've done fairly well. And we've spoken about world-class. Now, when you're dealing with human beings, it's so key to, if you have that ambition of being world-class, they obviously have to, you know, feel that way as well. And if they
align with that vision, yes.
If they understand how important their role is in the business, you've kind of won half the battle, because a lot of the staff that don't really give it their all, they don't really think that they're that key in the business. And this really comes from, I'm talking from your scholar roles, you know, your scholar guys that are, you know, in the kitchen, really just focusing on getting the cleanest, most pristine knives and forks, right through to the guys that, you know, get the glory, the baristas in front, you know, the guys that have the product knowledge. And we think we've done well in making them realize how important and how each component of the business works together, from your waiters to your baristas to your scholars and your chefs.
All right, a quick break and play. I hope you're enjoying the show, and I hope you're enjoying our Glenlivet Original by Tradition series. A wise man once said, "We are what we repeatedly do." Excellence then is not an act, but a habit. For me, this is what being the original is really all about. It's a mindset. It's forward looking. It's progressive. It's about not backing down to conformity or accepting mediocrity. It's about questioning norms, breaking assumptions. It's in the way that we combine resources creatively and use our talents in ways other people hadn't imagined. Ultimately, originality is really about people who are determined to do things on their own terms, redefining the way that we think about things like culture and success and achievement in the process. Originality is all about how we draw on our roots and show up winning again and again and again. A big thank you again from me to the team at Glenlivet for making these conversations possible. If you're enjoying the show as much as I'm enjoying recording it, please don't hesitate to share it with your network. And now, back to the podcast. So one of my favorite Joburg restaurants historically, when I first moved to the north of Johannesburg out of the east, which was a culture shock of note for me, but my weekly hangout, my favorite local was Polpetta, and the old Polpetta at 90 degrees on Rivonia, Ivano, who many people obviously knew from that restaurant, because it was one of those places that was kind of small and felt a little bit European and was always noisy, and there's a bunch of people coming in and out for takeaways. But the thing that always struck me about that store was how happy the wait staff seemed. And I was like, that's a new experience for me. In South Africa, like generally speaking, people in that kind of category of work are almost always treated like a commodity. You know, 100%. Companies are like, don't worry, there'll always be more waiters, waitresses, baristas, whatever it might be. You guys seem to have understood that those people are as much of the monarch experience as the product is, right? Like the people are critical to that. And the difference it makes when you are part of a culinary experience where the staff actually enjoy themselves and are happy and are energized and want to be there, like it tastes different. It literally physically tastes different. So Brad, I mean, this must be a big thing for you guys. You're scaling up, you're now, you know, since that first forecourt experience opened up, you've obviously rolled out a number of those, and now the flagship store. How do you as a business think about quality control and people and equipping people with that vision, you know, and that excitement that Nao has obviously alluded to? Like, talk us through some of the things that you guys do to make that a possibility.
So, yeah, obviously that is the biggest challenge that I think any business that's growing, especially when it comes to, you're creating a product that's not made from a factory, you know, you're creating a product that includes experience, it includes service, it includes a whole lot of things. The first thing that we've done is taken time to create proper systems, okay? Because once you've got that system standardized, and I'm talking about the way that the baristas are trained, the way that the chefs are, you know, are trained, the way that we run the store, the way that the books are done, etc. Those systems have all been, you know, a real priority so that we can get it down into a manual. Once you've got that manual, which is what we've got. I mean, we've got the training manuals, we've got the system manuals that are just about complete, because obviously that manual had to be edited now with this new type of shop that we've opened that includes food.
Of course, the
eatery,
of course,
is what,
yes.
what I like to call it, the cafe.
Mm.
The most important thing after that is having the right people, because you can teach those things, and we've seen it. We must have trained close to 100 people by now, you know, in terms as baristas, but we've only ever seen, let's say, 30 really excel.
Yeah.
And in those 30, there seems to be a common trait. The one is the willingness to learn, but that comes with a certain level of humility. Let me tell you that, like, the more humble people that come in there, and I'm talking about guys that were so shy, okay, that they couldn't even have the interview, you know, have really excelled as a barista because of their willingness to be taught, to learn. So
a complete lack of entitlement, basically, and a real desire to gain a new skill.
And completely the opposite for the ones that haven't been successful.
Of course, yeah.
And that comes to, I mean, this is where I've got to give Neo all the props on that. I mean, it's such a massive part of the business. And this, I mean, if anybody's listening out there and everybody wants to know whether, you know, what are the keys to success? And that is get the right people to find the right staff, because you will burn yourself so many times. Like, I've learned, I mean, I've had people that I loved that have been completely different people, you know, 3 months down the line. So, yeah, the rollouts, I mean, we've got the look and feel, right? We've got the brand. The brand has always been the thing that I always tell people. I'm not a restaurateur. I love building the brand. That's for me. I want to get the brand out there. And we're literally building the biggest coffee company in the world.
Yeah.
And we've said that from day one. And I want to see if we can do it. Do you know, like, why not? Like, why not? If not us, then who?
Maybe. Sure.
And in fact, I mean, Brad always corrects me here, and it's not even an if. We will do it. I mean, he always corrects me as well, and we will do it. It will be the biggest business in the world. Now, you spoke about just some of the elements that have contributed to us being really giving that experience. Now, just to add on to the staff element, now we live in a very, very diverse society, right? You know, some of our biggest strengths actually is the diversity, but it's also our biggest challenge. I mean, I think you know, a lot of people recognize that. And how do you manage that challenge in the workplace when there's so much at play? There's the economic aspect of people trying to survive. There's the political aspect of, you know, ideologies flying through your staff's head as well. And when people look at the business, you know, they look at, okay, Bradley. I mean, we're talking our South African society.
Let's talk.
You know, you know, they look at Brad. Brad is white. I'm black. Okay, lekker. So at least they've got that representation at ownership level. But actually, there's actually three of us. And, you know, there's Brad alone, first of all. And not only that, you know, we actually do have Muslim partners as well. But now let me take it a level further into the business. The strength that we have is that I can get through to some of our staff that are unable to see further than just being a waiter, that are unable to see further than, you know, having the title of a barista. Because, look, we come from the same backgrounds. You know, I grew up in Soweto. Like, I was raised by my grandmother. You know, typical kind of type of background. Unfortunately, at the time, as a kid, didn't have my father in my life. You know, it took about, 36 years before, you know, he became active. And those are very common narratives. And once I speak to, and it's not just a Neo thing, but anybody in a similar position of leadership like myself, once they speak to their staff, it just, for whatever human reason, it just, you know, kind of sounds and they can kind of relate and listen a little bit more closely. Whereas when Bradley comes in, you know, we've already got now what? We've got the ideologies, we've got the politics, we've got everything else that goes outside the work, I mean, outside the business, that affect that communication. And I guess my background, you know, with the recruitment and consulting and kind of careers and empowerment of people in that space allows me to communicate it a bit better. Because being a waiter is not just being a waiter. You've just said it yourself. If our staff are happy, genuinely, not just, you know, face smile and at the back, you know, people upset, the food tastes better. That's all energy. I know there's people that are like, energy what? It's all energy. And if my barista understands that for them to be, you know, engaging Or even if they just reserve baristas and they're not necessarily the guys that kind of like speak out to customers, but for them to learn the skill of being a barista and possibly at some level, maybe going to a table and waitering. And you know what? For them to be proactive and say, listen, whoever's not feeling well, I'm actually going to go help out in the kitchen if I'm allowed to. That's actually learning a skill. One or two or three or four of them may want to actually have their businesses at some point in their lives. Now, if you've got the business, if you've got the skill of understanding what happens on the floor, you understand the product itself, you've seen what happens in the kitchen, you're so much of a better employee that can be considered for some type of employee schemes, for some type of growth in our plans as a business. Who do we want to head a shop or to partner with a potential investor, whatever the, however it may look in future? We would want people that understand the brand. And once you as an employer are able to make them see that I'm not bringing you in just to be a waiter. Obviously, it all depends on the vision of the business. But there are possibilities. And if you, I cannot give you an opportunity to be a supervisor or even a chef if you cannot master the one skill of being a barista, of being on time, of doing your stock take, of engaging your customers, of understanding that, yes, I may have personal problems at home, but actually it's not my customer's fault. Of understanding that you know, when you walk in, it's your first cup of coffee, but it's actually my 400th and my customer doesn't know that. I have to make it like it's the first coffee. If you don't understand those basic principles, and if us as employers cannot communicate them as clear enough, then you kind of do have that imbalance in the struggle for them to buy into your vision as a business.
And the tragedy often in South Africa is that that experience, that those kinds of skills, that can't be bought. You don't learn that at a Damlin or at a Varsity or whatever. Like, you only learn that in the working situation and in a specific kind of environment. So it really is a precious gift to gain that kind of experience in that. I mean, I've often said, like, my son has to, as soon as he's able, go and wait tables somewhere.
Yeah, I agree.
Because you learn something in that environment that you just don't learn anywhere else, around customer service, around the pressure of that kind of space, around your conduct, around initiative, all of those elements that you've spoken to.
Yeah.
So guys, I want to ask you, because you mentioned this, I think now, and I want to get back to this point around, there's a narrative, and especially at the moment in South Africa, about how difficult it is to start businesses and how difficult it is to find support for them, and how there's so much that's working against us from an economic or cultural or political perspective. And what's really interesting about your story is, I mean, honestly, if Brad had come to me in 2015 and said, Mike, I'm thinking of starting a coffee business, I would have gone, you know, because like I've often subscribed to that sort of thing. And I would have said, well, maybe start a software development business. What I think is so great about your guys' story, and I think what we all have to hear and take to heart, is that yes, this is a uniquely complicated and complex place that we love and hate and love, depending on the day, right? But because of that complexity, it produces a different type of business. If you succeed here, there is something about the DNA of your organization that is going to be different. There's a resilience, a level of creativity, which I think you were talking about now, that comes from diversity of thought, diversity of leadership, diversity of challenge, right? So Brad, like the question I guess I want to put to you as you build the biggest coffee business in the world is, what is the thing that makes you different to the other brands?
It's simple. Yeah. Authenticity.
Okay.
And that stems into a lot of different aspects of the business. But the first thing, and it goes into the black and white story. You know, a lot of companies today, have got a BEE face in the business. Mm. Okay. And I mean, now and I have been having these conversations before we even started a business, you know, how, you know, it really doesn't do anybody that much good, you know, and it's kind of an insult to be invited into a business as a face rather than, listen, you've got skills. You happen to be of a certain race. Here's a position. And it was never about that, you know. It's never been like that for us in terms of the relationship.
Posturing or window dressing.
Darren and I have been sitting, I mean, in class since grade 8. We sat next to each other almost throughout until matric. We've been talking about these things. I always knew that I could see that Nao got treated differently to me in the same school by the same teachers. You know, those things were real. And we spoke about them. And, you know, it was quite refreshing. It gave me a different angle on things. I took that with me wherever I went, and I noticed that that wasn't, you know, the common sort of trait amongst people. People weren't having these open conversations with people of the other race. This is now back in, what, 1998?
Yeah. Four years after 94.
4 years after 94. And things are still not right, you know, today. But going back to your point, what is going to make us succeed? This is what I see here. I see that the world is starved for truly excellent African brands. Okay, there's space for it. There's a lot of black consciousness coming around. You've got the BLM. You've got, you know, not necessarily just black. It's like people of color or people of minorities are really starting to take pride, you know, in who they are and what they do. Okay, we, you know, so the rest of the world and we look to Europe, we look to America for our brands and our brand choices and what do we do? You know, and you start to look at what South Africans, and I'm talking about like really high level, because there are a lot of products they're not of world-class standard. But the ones that are, they're not just world-class, they're the best in the world. I mean, if you look at guys like Makosa and the fashion that he's doing, it is phenomenal. Like you can just see Black Coffee. You know, he's a brand in himself. Those type of things. The world is really starting to look at Africa for these brands. And it's also because, you know, it gives people that are living or that have been displaced, you know, through centuries or whatever, it just gives them a touch point to go back home. Do you know, there's just some sort of feeling, there's some sort of pride, let's support. And with that, I think we've created something that we can export. You know, something that people do want. Anybody, you know, when I've got a lot of people from different countries, you know, from my time overseas, they're looking back at our brand and saying, when is it coming to our country? Canada, South Korea, the United States, there have been some real offers that we've gotten from people there. And it just goes back to the point that you asked me before. You know, it's all very well. I'm pretty sure we could get investors in all these countries to come and, you know, to do it. But then how are we going to, you know, how are we going to grow the brand? Is it going to be the same thing? So we're spending this time to develop exactly what we are so that there's no guessing, and then we're going to push it through.
And no compromising.
No, exactly. No compromising either. And we've got to get what it's worth. But the authenticity is the thing. I mean, the reason that your waiters are happy at our stores is because they feel it. You know, the way that we do coffee, we're not pretending to be great. We've gone and sourced really good, high quality beans. You know, we've gone and we've got the specialty stuff that we've got sitting in our hoppers. I can guarantee that there's no other coffee house in the country that has got that specialty grade. Yeah. I've gone and found it, okay, and I've brokered a deal so that we can get small enough amounts so that it's worth it for us to sell it here. Nobody's doing that. You know, the specialty coffee. Yes, we charge 65 rand a cup of coffee if you want the specialty stuff. You don't have to have it, but if you want it, it's there, and we sell out. So those are the things that we're doing differently, but it's because it comes from us, you know. One of the things early on in the business that guy was a guide to us was, if I walk into the shop and I don't feel like drinking my coffee, okay, we've got a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So it was at a moment like that where we were like, okay, cool, we're going to create the Nguni blend. Where it was like, okay, cool, let's try something else. Then we got Nguni. Yes. Then what else do I want in the shop? What would I be looking for as a... Because we're coffee fanatics, you know? What am I looking for? Okay, I need a more pour-over stuff or more speciality stuff. Or what can we add to go with the coffee? So it's all coming from us. It's authentic, you know? And I think at some point we'll be able to write that down as, this is who we are, and then duplicate that.
You know, Brad talks about, I mean, when he first started, he spoken about, you know, obviously the element of, you know, black and white, and that's South African thing. And it is actually world leading. We have those dynamics. And then, you know, we linked authenticity. Now, the authenticity was so easy because we went to a diverse school, right? A school that actually accommodated everyone. In the time, 4 years after 94, school, you know, accommodated everyone. Yes, it had its challenges. I mean, there is actually spaces like that are not perfect in the same way the country is not perfect. And it was very easy for that friendship to just, you know, just grow organically and have its ups and its downs. And here we are 23 years later. Now, this is where, for me, which pulls a little bit away from what Brad just said, but this is where I feel kind of like we shouldn't do our kids that disservice of not being in multicultured environments. because you then expect them 20 years down the line to then kind of slot in and represent the country.
Yeah.
How does the country look? And then you're sitting across the table, somebody that you don't know, that you don't understand. They're just as human as you are. They have their ups and downs. But then we expect for those spaces to flourish. And that's what kind of like, you know, I always, you know, think about the special element that has come into this business, which is, you know, its uniqueness and its authenticity. Our relationships are all authentic. As organic as we met Kumlani, our other partner, it's still authentic. I've been his friend now for the last 5 years, right? So if there's anything that anyone can take away from our business that is not even, say, business related, is don't do your kids that disfavor of limiting the type of environment that they're in, because we live in a diverse world.
Not even in a diverse world.
And if we're going to foster that, those pockets of love, of authenticity, of high quality, it has to come from, you know, foster it in their minds while they're still young. Because today, I now, and Brad and partners have to sit with our staff and tell them that, listen, boy, you don't have to end off as just a waiter. You know, there's actually something called a supply chain, a value chain.
There's a career path here.
100%. There's a career path.
Yeah.
You don't have to be stuck here. You'll be a brilliant barista, but I tell you what, you may actually be an even better Q grader, or you may be an even better, person that works on the farm or actually travels and identifies the different beans. There's actually a career path. Mm-hmm. And where does it all come from? The authenticity of our relationship and the vision that we have for, you know, for Manaka.
It's interesting because you can make a product or a business look African or look South African. You know, you slap an Ndebele pattern on something or you do it. But to make something African, you know, kind of intrinsically so that it has the DNA. And what's interesting about succeeding, like, and you've mentioned a couple of other brands that I think are good examples of that happening, is when you feel it, it's very difficult to articulate exactly what it is, but it's A, it's desirable, and B, it's infectious. You want more of it. You like, it's almost addictive, right? Because you can sense that there is something there that you can't manufacture, which is a really powerful thing. And I think I'm unafraid to say this is not a sponsored post. It is something that you guys have achieved, you know. So kudos to you, and I wish nothing more for you than your ability to scale and continue to amplify that magic in everything that you do, because it's clearly there now. Yeah,
you're so spot on, Mike. Listen, I just want to tell you, how your interpretation or your description now of that thing is just perfect, like. Yeah, sometimes
cool. My check's in the post, bud.
No, but no, for real. Like you obviously, you know, you're exceptional at what you do. That's why you've had the success that you've had. But it's in identifying things like that, right? That's where brands live. It's not in the posters. It's not you know, it's not the facade. You know, the brand is deeper than that, and you just hit on it perfectly there. It's quite difficult to describe normally.
Yeah, it's something that somebody once said to me, great advice. They said, your brand is not what you tell your customer it is. It's what your customer is telling their friends it is, right? And that's the difference between the two things. And I think you guys have understood that perfectly. So at the end of each of these shows, I ask a guest two questions, which I think are helpful questions for people who are listening. And instead of asking you both questions, what I want to do is split them up. So Brad, I'm going to start with you with the first question. If you could go back in time to 1998, 18 years old. I think we're the same age. Are we the same age?
I'm 36.
How old were you in 98?
98, I was 13, 14.
14, yeah.
Oh, okay. We're not the same age then. All right, good. If you could go back to 18-year-old you, let me not give away my age. What single piece of advice would you give 18-year-old Brad if you could go back in time and speak to him?
You know what? If I could go back in time, I wouldn't take away the party years. Okay, I would say enjoy those years, but shorten them a little bit. I would have got started on creating something a lot earlier in my life, maybe from the age of 25. So I only got into this at 32, 33, and had I been able to start it at 25, I just think it would have given me more energy to trade, you know, because that's what I find business is. It's like you're taking the energy that you've got and you're turning it into something that is hopefully going to support you later. right?
Yeah. Like, and I suppose those lessons are cheaper to learn at a younger age. Exactly. So yeah, there's that benefit as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that being said, I mean, it's almost impossible for me to have gotten there at that age because of the experience that I needed to get to at 32.
Sure. You know?
That would be it, though.
Nao, my question for you is, if you could prescribe a book that should go into the schooling system and be something that every kid growing up in South Africa should read, what book would it be and why?
And he says a book because that's brilliant, because I didn't even finish my English novels in grade 10. So he just moved okay, tell us which book, Wiki. Well, I tell you what, honestly, I think, you know, some of the books that I've read are more political than anything else. And the one that has kind of struck me is the Super Afrikaners, right? The Afrikaner Blue Report. And the reason it struck me is because in as much as a lot that has been done in that period of Broederbond and it being an overlay and a system of apartheid, there's a lot that I feel that, you know, I learned, and there's a lot that I think that the political system can learn, and not from a point of, now I don't want to focus on the negative, which is the oppression and focusing on only, you know, specific, say communities, but just, you know, when you have a genuine and an authentic vision, when it's genuine, and I want to underline that genuine part. If the vision is genuine and the will is actually innocent and thorough, you can achieve. We can turn it around. We can turn 100%. It around. And the common thread we've mentioned in this very interview is the authenticity. And if that was trickle upwards, right? Because we'll do what we can do downwards. We can do it. But if it was to kind of trickle upwards, I think we would definitely replicate a lot of businesses like ours, a lot of friendships like ours. And look, read it. Some of you won't get into business, but some of you will kind of have the view and outlook of what it means to be organized, what it means to actually be genuine. And hopefully, you know, it can change your approach to whatever that you're experiencing in life.
Gentlemen, as a fan and as a friend and as a South African, I'm just really grateful for the work you're doing. I know it's been hard work. I know it always looks like it's easy on the outside, but I know the background is just nonstop slog, sweat and tears. The fact that you guys have paid that price to create a space that brings us a beautifully South African and uniquely South African product, but also it gives hundreds of people opportunities for work. And I can only imagine where it's going to go to from here. I'm really grateful, and I want to wish you guys the best of luck for the future. I think it's going to go from strength to strength. So thanks for taking the time, and thanks for the work you do.
Thanks, Mike. That's brilliant.
Thank you very much. This platform itself is going to just echo this session, which I think a lot of people will learn from. So the work that you're doing shouldn't be asked.
Lucky, guys.
Thank you.
Cool. We'll chat to you soon. See you at the store. You've been listening to the One-Eyed Man podcast. I'm Mike Stopforth, an entrepreneur, writer, and public speaker, deeply curious about discovering better ways to lead and better ways to live in an increasingly complex world. I find the best source of these ideas is the experience and wisdom of interesting people who are taking unconventional approaches to solving the world's most compelling problems. If you'd like to hear from someone I haven't yet spoken to, visit mikestopforth.com. Click on the podcast link and send through your suggestions. A big thanks to the Solid Gold Podcast Studios in Johannesburg, South Africa for making this production possible. And remember, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man/person is king.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.